Christians know that regular, intentional reading of the Bible can be a great source of comfort and growth. The gospel is everywhere in the scriptures. But there are difficult passages that might tend to make us uncomfortable. Parts of the Old Testament contain a historical record of violence commanded by God. Israel's conquest of Canaan in Deuteronomy 7, for example. For those of us who hold dear Jesus' admonition to turn the other cheek, how do we deal with this? It's next on Craving Answers, Craving God. I'm Chuck Rathert with Aaron Miller. Aaron is the senior pastor at Trinity Lutheran Church in Springfield, Illinois. Aaron, I think there are some of us Christians who like to stay in the New Testament. There we have the record of Jesus' loving and atoning work on the cross and the birth and early years of the church. But that Old Testament, there's some rough stuff there. Better to focus on the new rather than the old. What do you think?
There's no New Testament without an Old Testament. Obviously there's...
just a testament.
Yeah, it would just be a testament then. But it is the... there's no way to know what Jesus is doing if you don't know the Old Testament. Everything he's doing, he is living and teaching and acting and dying and rising from the dead like he thinks he's the climax to Israel's great story. And if you don't know Israel's great story, then you don't know what he's doing. And it's like watching the last scene of a movie. And so if I walk in on my wife or my daughters watching a movie and it's right near the end, my temptation is to say, what's going on? Who's that? Why is he doing that? Which of course is super annoying to them because they're like, well, there's no way for you to know. You could make some stuff up here and we could just say, oh, that's the good guy in the movie. But you don't really know what he's gone through without seeing the whole story. And I get it. That's where Jesus is at, is in the New Testament. But he's just as present in many special ways in the Old Testament. I just think it's bad baseball to try and ignore the Old Testament for the New Testament. You just misunderstand everything.
So let's just assume that I'm a devoted New Testament Christian. I really like the Gospels. I like the stories and the study, the history, Book of Acts, things like that. Mm-hmm. And I have spent a little time in the Old Testament, but I don't know. I just can't connect the dots there. It's hard slogging there. And I think pastors say things like you just say, because they know that it's like that, but they think that we should read the Old Testament too. So they twist our arms a little bit. What do you have to say to me?
Seriously, it's not like a legalistic, oh, you ought to read that too. Or even like, well, it's God's word. It's good for you. It's not that. I'll just say, so you could take the Old Testament away from the Gospels and what you would have, I'm just going to make something up here. You could imagine Jesus as this wise philosopher character wandering around saying cryptic stories designed to get people to look at the way they've shaped their lives and to think more about love. And then the authorities get irritated with him because he's just like poking the bear everywhere he goes. And so they kill him. But there's this miraculous coming back from the dead. What does that mean? Maybe that's a metaphor for his teachings live on. You can kill the man, but you can't kill his teachings. You could do that. But if you actually start with the Old Testament and you see that God has decided to bring blessing to his world, he's decided to reverse the curse by calling this guy named Abraham and commissioning him to be his agent, him and his family, to reflect God's glory back to the world. And he's going to do that by following God's commandments, looking and acting differently, and especially by caring about in his body this future offspring who's going to come and make blessing happen to all the nations. If you start there in Genesis 12 and track that story all the way through the Exodus and God coming and living with his people in the tabernacle and the need for a king and the rise of David and his family and then their rebellion and the exile and the temple being destroyed and God's people being dispersed to the four corners of the globe and them longing and wondering what happened to the offspring promise. Where is David's son that was promised us? Where is Abraham's seed now? Where is God? Is God ever going to come back and live here in the midst of his people? And then when you get to Jesus and you hear the angel say to Joseph in chapter 1 of Matthew, this baby is going to be Emmanuel, God with us. God's coming back home. All of that is necessary to understanding what that, it's not just like God has decided to implant his wisdom in this chosen one who is going to give you great teachings whereby to order your life and to live faithfully in this world. No, no, no. God's acting to come back home to earth in the person of Jesus. But you need the whole Old Testament to do that. And so if any of our listeners are like not reading the Old Testament, just start doing it. Not because it's a rule, but it's good stuff. And you won't understand Jesus without it.
All right, you win. You've put a dent in my ambivalence toward the Old Testament.
Good, good, good.
I think to myself, well, if I'm not reading the Old Testament, what really am I missing? Well, I know one thing I'm not missing, and that's the narratives there of complete destruction,
violent destruction.
In the aforementioned Deuteronomy 7, God gives instructions to his now liberated people who he's taken out of Egypt. They are to take possession of the quote-unquote promised land. And he instructs them to wipe out the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and just for good measure, the Jebusites. Can you square that command to the liberated people from Egypt with Jesus' later words, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you?
Yeah, I don't know if it's really... I don't know if it's my place or I'm pretty certain I don't have the ability to square it. I'll say that it's ugly. The Old Testament, those texts about destroying your enemies is ugly. It's offensive to my sensibilities as a human being, even as a Christian. One thing we've put this topic off a long time and I cannot believe I was looking back through and like, have we talked about this before? We haven't. It's really bizarre to me. And why it's bizarre to me is because this is the one question that like, I have no problem talking to unbelievers and skeptics about Christianity. And I always feel like I'm in a place to say things to them about Christianity that they're going to say, oh yeah, that's good. Even if they disagree, even if they don't want to become Christians. This is the one topic that it gets under my skin. I don't mean it irritates me, but I'm always like, dang it. I don't have anything. This is going to be hard to talk
about. Tougher road to hoe.
This is a tougher road to hoe. And I was wondering, this has been several years ago now, I was wondering, why is it that this particular apologetic topic, why does this really like get me on my back legs? And I think it's because, here's my conclusion. And I'm grateful to skeptics who bring this up now because it's a reminder that the God of the Bible isn't the nice, tame God that I've grown accustomed to in my American Christianity. The God of the Bible isn't this super sweet guy. He's not always gentle and meek. He hates what's been done to his good creation. And he most of all hates what's been done to his human image bearers by sin. He hates it like I've said this before, I think, in here, or at least in sermons. He hates this stuff like the mom who lost a daughter to heroin addiction hates heroin. She hates this stuff like a wife whose husband is battling with cancer hates cancer. She doesn't hate her husband. The woman doesn't hate her daughter, but they hate the evil disease that's trapped them. God hates it. And if he decides to say, now it's time for radical surgery, it's scary. I'm not saying we should like it. Nobody likes to go through surgery. But there's a sense in which we really need to understand what he's up to. He's trying. And this is, by the way, I know that like I've talked to skeptics who have said, well, this is just like, genocide. God just like kills whole peoples because of their ethnicity. And the point isn't, you know, ethnic genocide. The point isn't even killing people. The point is purity. It's immoral. God is commanding his people, Israel, to be moral. No, it sounds horrible. To be holy. That's a better word. To be holy like he's holy. You know, and I'm not the first person to point this out, but it's clear when, like, if you look at this list, and I've got Deuteronomy 7 I'm looking at it right now. You know, the Hittites, the Girgashites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites. So this is in Deuteronomy 7. Israel doesn't wipe out the Jebusites. They're still in the land as late as 2 Samuel. Israel doesn't wipe out the Canaanites. Israel doesn't wipe all these people out. In fact, in Deuteronomy, at some point, God tells them, you know, conquer the land little by little, not all at one time. So this language, I'm not the first person to point this out. It isn't the case that God said in Deuteronomy 7, wipe them out or drive them out, and then God's people go and just kill everybody they can find. They don't. In fact, we find people from foreign pagan countries who actually come and become a part of Israel, and they don't get wiped out. They actually get assimilated in. They convert to worshiping the one true God. And so this language is, I think it's hyperbolic. It's not the case that Israel goes around killing everybody, but it is the case that God tells them this level of immorality cannot exist in the promised land. It can't exist in the promised land. And Israel fails many times in their quest for holiness, but at least they know from the beginning that God doesn't want them acting like this. And that's the other thing. Here's some historical context. I know I've said this in here before. It's not like the Canaanites are all just cheating on their taxes, you know, and they refuse to cross the street at the crosswalk. And they're driving 25 through the school zone instead of 15. It's not that they're all these nice people. We know from archaeology as well as a lot of ancient writing that the Canaanites sacrificed their kids. They would mingle the blood of their infants in the mortar of the homes they built for good luck. This, you know, like, God is determined to get rid of these people who believe that there's value in destroying innocent human life. And if you see it that way, it's less, I find it easier to understand if you see it in terms of holiness. Okay, can I just one more example, Chuck, and then I'll let you talk. Sorry, I'm blabbering on here. In 1945, the Canadians and the Brits and the Americans in the West and the Russians in the East went through and wiped out every opposing force they can find of the Germans. And they were determined to get to Berlin, and they were going to destroy Hitler and his cronies if he didn't destroy himself first, which he did. Why? So as an American, why did we do that? Germany never attacked us. Why did we do it? We did it because of holiness. There's a people, the Nazis, who were killing innocent people, Jews, people who were disabled, people with Down syndrome, homosexuals, gypsies, other, not just Jews, but communists, Christians who sided with trying to save the Jews. We went over there, and nobody's troubled by that at all. You know, no modern person is like, oh, that's evil.
Kind of proud of it.
We're kind of proud of it, right? Why? Because we understand that there are some things that are worth stopping other people from doing. You know, some group of people are determined to wipe out Judaism and Jews in Europe. It's worth going over there and killing them to stop that. Why is it that that's okay with us, but somehow we don't like this God of the Bible who's doing the same thing? Wiping out people who are murdering their babies, who are indulging in human sacrifice. I think it's maybe a touch hypocritical, or just people don't, they lack the historical context. I'm not saying, by the way, I'm not saying that World War II is good and we should celebrate it. It was a horrible thing. And I've known personally and in my churches, people who fought in World War II who refused to talk about it. It was so horrible. They refused to talk about it. But what they did was righteous. What they did was righteous. And I think that we're tapping in a little bit to what's going on here in Deuteronomy.
Oh, boy, this is kind of a difficult subject here. So let's go back to the comfort of the New Testament for just a little bit. You know, Jesus seems to talk a lot about peace. In John 14, speaking to his followers, he says, quote, "Peace I leave with you, my peace I give to you." Isn't that nice? Isn't that comfortable? But in the Old Testament, God seems not to be a God of peace, but a God of war. So as we compare and contrast the Jesus of peace in the New Testament and the God of war in the Old Testament, is that an inconsistency or maybe even worse yet, a contradiction?
I think it is an inconsistency. I think that one thing that Christians have done in the past, and sometimes they've been so blatant about it, they've been called, you know, outside of the Christian faith, like Marcion, is to say, oh, the God of the Old Testament is like violent and masculine. He's flexing his arms and beating people up he disagrees with. And the God of the New Testament is this really sweet, meek and mild carpenter who comes to teach love. So clearly we're talking about two different gods. I think that's a huge mistake. Or even that God's vibe changes. Now, I do want to say the crucifixion does change stuff. It does. It makes a huge, massive difference. I guess that's not really a hot take for a Christian pastor to say. But the God of the Old Testament is a God of peace, too. One of his names is, and Gideon names him this in Judges 6, Jehovah Shalom, Yahweh Shalom, God of peace. He's a God of peace then. The God of the New Testament is a God of violence. This is maybe a separate topic here, but they're related. The violence doesn't stop. God's determination to wipe out sinfulness, like an oncologist is determined to wipe out cancer, that doesn't stop in the New Testament. It actually comes to its climax. But, and I said that the crucifixion changes things, there God has decided that he himself will go under the knife, that he himself will take the bullet, that God himself, you know, Jesus doesn't get rid of the violence. He takes the violence into himself for us so that we don't have to...
Unspeakable
violence into himself so that we can avoid it. And that does change things. It doesn't make God any less holy or determined to get rid of evil, but it does mean that his gun sights are turned on himself. He chooses to die for us so that we don't have to die. And that does make a sense in the temperature of the New Testament versus the Old Testament.
So, you know, I do have kind of a problem because here I am in my New Testament comfy chair, feeling all good about peaceful Jesus. But then I run into this scripture in Matthew 10. Jesus, peaceful Jesus, says this, "Do not think that I have come to bring peace to the earth. I have not come to bring peace, but a sword." Well, that kind of upsets my apple cart. I think I'd rather go back to the previous peaceful Jesus.
But, right, yeah.
But I guess I have to hold the two together. So can you take advantage of this awkward moment for me as I've discovered that Jesus may not just be the wimpy, peaceful guy that sometimes I'd like to make him into?
Yeah, he like his father, hates sin as well. He, like his father, is not always content with saying, hey, stop doing wrong. Sometimes he goes into the temple and throws the tables over. He, like his father, is willing to use violence to purify the earth. He is willing to use it on himself. But that's, you know, sometimes we talk about the cross as an expression of God's love, which is absolutely true. And I want to talk about that more than I talk about what we're talking about now. I do. Because I think the Bible puts the weight on that. But they're not separate. It's an expression of his love because it's an expression of his anger at what's been done wrong. And he loves because he's angry at what's been done wrong. And what the text in the Old Testament about God's determination to wipe out those who rebel against him do is they fill in the content of what Jesus is so, why he's so determined to die on the cross, why it's so important that he die on the cross. It's his hatred for the damage that sin has done to his human creatures. He's willing to embrace all that violence, all the violence that the Girgashites and the Jebusites and the Hivites and the Hittites and the Canaanites. He wants all of that on himself. He wants to take the bullet. And what the Deuteronomy 7 text you read does is it lets us know exactly what's at stake on the cross. This is how bad it is. Imagine if somebody could take all the evil of the Holocaust on themselves and rescue everybody involved. Jesus is doing that, but way, way more. It's not just the Holocaust. It's every bit of sin, and it's every bit of violence and murder and war, and it's every white lie. It's every tiny little niggling bitter thought. It's every little scant, hardly noticeable touch of jealousy that somebody else is getting something that you like. He takes all of those and sums them up on himself and allows himself to be killed by his human creatures to fight back against that evil.
Well, I think you have probably spoken already to this point, but I just maybe can draw it a little bit closer to focus, setting up a hypothetical. Let's say you're talking with a friend about the Christian faith, and your friend says something like, I just can't believe in a God who inflicted so much death and destruction, the one that I read about in the Old Testament. The flood, Sodom and Gomorrah, the plagues of Egypt, etc., all those things. It's just a deal breaker for me. Your turn.
Yeah, this is a, yeah, I honestly, I don't, I totally understand it. Like he's, if your idea of God is this kindly, nice man who always is trying to make your life better and to extend your health, then yeah, this is not the God of the Bible. The God of the Bible is a God who is determined to cut sin out like the cancer it is. And if he has to hack your body open and leave you with a whole lifetime full of rehab to recover from that, he's willing to do it to save you. But I should say not even to you, but to himself. He hacks his own body open to do that. The question, and I know I've said this in here before, the question isn't, you know, if somebody says to me, that's a deal breaker, I can't believe in a God like that, I'll probably say something along the lines of, okay, so let's be intellectually honest though. You're not saying that you don't believe in a God like that. You're saying, I don't like a God like that. That's a different thing. The question is there a God who is willing to kill himself to get rid of sin? That's the question. If there is, you're free to say you don't like it, but you are not free to say he doesn't exist just because you don't like it. And I, again, the examples, you know, if the bad guys, if the commies are dropping a nuclear missile on my town, I don't like that. I think that's wrong. I'll just come out right now and say it. I don't want that to happen. That's one thing. It's another thing to go to the town square and shake my fist at the sky and say, I refuse to believe in nuclear missiles because I hate what they do to my city. That's going to get me killed. You don't, the example I've given before, you don't want to stand on the beach and shake your fist at the tsunami and say, I hate tsunamis. You're evil and you destroy property. I refuse to believe in you. That's a deal breaker for me. You're going to get drowned. What you want to do is say, okay, I don't like the tsunami, but the tsunami is there. How am I going to come to grips with it? How am I going to grapple with reality as it is? And what I came to 20 years ago was this. I might not like God. I might not like his rules. I might not like the things that I blame him for doing to me. But the question is not, do I like him or not? The question is he there? And if he's there, I'm going to have to grapple with him. And what I found is that the God that I didn't like, once I've come to grapple with him and say, okay, well, you're God and I'm not. What do I need to do? I found out that what I thought was him torturing me, what I thought was experiments in vivisection, that he just wanted to cut my body parts up to watch me bleed for his own enjoyment or because he didn't care, was actually him just doing surgery. He's just trying to make me healthy. I've told you this before too. I think I have. I took my daughter Kate when she was 2 years old to get some stitches, and they were in her face, and I had to hold her down on the operating tables. I guess it's kind of an operation getting stitches. In the emergency room, I'm holding her down while this doctor is putting stitches in her face. And she is so angry and so hurt and so betrayed by me. And all she knew was this strange man with this beard and this white coat on was jabbing her face with this sharp instrument. That's all she knew. I think she looks back now in retrospect and thinks, I should not have screamed at that guy because he was actually trying to make it so that I had no scars on my face when I grew up to be an 18-year-old girl and would be very, very embarrassed if there was a scar on my face. That's where she's at now. But at the time, in her 2-year-old brain, all she could think was, I hate this guy. My brain's frequently a 2-year-old brain.
Didn't like you very much either.
No. Betrayed. That was the hardest. One of the hardest things I've ever had to do was to hold her down and try and explain to her what was going on when I know she couldn't understand it. My brain's a 2-year-old brain too about God. Why are you doing this? I don't like you. I wish you didn't exist. When I probably should just be mature and lay there and be grateful that he's performing surgery on his son to rescue me. And that's what I found, is that the God who I thought was a big meanie actually is just trying to love his creation and love me.
Well, let me change that hypothetical. Let's say I'm sitting there with a Christian friend, kind of the same situation. He's troubled by all the violence he sees in the Old Testament, and he says it's a deal breaker for him. But instead of doing a thoughtful explanation, as you just demonstrated, I get flippant and I say, hey, God is God. He can do whatever he wants. If he wants to tear him up in the Old Testament, that's up to him. If he wants to be peaceful Jesus in the New Testament, whatever. It is flippant, and I think it probably leaves me satisfied in the conversation, but not my friend. What do you think?
Yeah, it is flippant. I mean, the problem with it is that it's right about God's power and volition. It's wrong about, well, it implies no love there. You know, God does whatever he wants, just get over it. What I tried to do in my last example was to say, yes, God does whatever he wants. We have to grapple with that at some point. But you should know that whatever he wants is good. He always wants good. He always wants to heal. He will not tolerate people who destroy his creation. He will go in and get rid of Hitler. He will. And what I'm trying to say is love. You got to put that in the formula too. We don't want a God who's gentle and meek and mild and doesn't get rid of the bad guys. Any more than we wanted Roosevelt and Stalin and Churchill to get together and say, all right, we don't like Hitler. We think it's bad that he's trying to wipe out European Jewry, but we don't feel like it's very nice of us to stop him. We think that in the name of kindness and peace, we probably ought to just, if he needs advice, we're here, but we think that we shouldn't stop him. You would say,
we call that cowardly.
That's evil. Yeah, not just cowardly, but evil. Evil. You are abandoning your obligation as leaders of the free world. Well, in the case of Churchill and Roosevelt, I don't know if Stalin falls in that category, but you're abandoning your obligation to protect innocence from destruction. We want our leaders to defend us. You know, if somebody comes in my house and tries to harm one of my kids, and I stand by and I say, oh, sheesh, I really want to be nice. I don't want to be mean. You would say I'm a horrible father. If we have a God who refuses to try and cleanse his creation of the evil that's destroying it, we would say he's not a God worth worshiping. We deep down inside, we want a God of justice. We even want a God of violence, just like we wanted Churchill and Stalin and Roosevelt to be violent, getting rid of Hitler. We crave that. And a God who isn't violent in the attempts to get rid of this cancer, which it's worked its way down into the very soil of this creation, A God who's not willing to be violent to do that is not a God worth worshiping. Now, the fact that he's taken that violence and summed it up in himself is unbelievably miraculous. He has every right to blow each and every one of us. That's the other thing. Like, I can't believe in a God who would kill somebody. Well, he kills everybody. He told us in the Garden of Eden, if you obey me, if you disobey me, you will surely die. And now we've disobeyed him. We're all going to die. It's just our just deserts. The fact that he's figured out a way to kill himself and rise from the dead so that we won't stay dead forever is icing on the cake. That's a God I want to worship, a God who's both powerful and just and holy and loving and has a plan to make all things new. That's the God I want.
So I want to try to wrap this up by bringing it into the sharpest focus that we can bring it. And I think I might have complicated that quest a little bit when I quoted Matthew 10, where Jesus says, "Do not think that I have come to bring peace to the earth. I have not come to bring peace, but a sword." What, it's a fact that the wrath of God is mentioned in both Testaments,
right,
Old and New. It's mentioned at least 18 times in the New Testament, 7 times in the book of Revelation alone. So if I were to tell you that I struggle to grasp the nature of God as being simultaneously loving and wrathful, which seem to be contradictory positions, what would you say?
The opposite of love is apathy, not wrath.
I thought the opposite of love was hate.
No, they're opposite sides of the same coin. I know we've done this before. If you slap my wife, I will hate you to the extent that I love my wife. You know, if you wreck my car, I'll be upset because it costs me money to fix that. If you burn my house down, I'll be angry. If you harm my wife and my kids, I will hate. I will hate. With a righteous hatred, with a righteous anger. I don't know if we should distinguish between hatred and anger, but just for right now, everybody, let it go. Just hang with the analogy here. I like my car. I really like my house. I love my family. My anger, my wrath goes up commensurate with my love level. Love, far from being the opposite of anger and wrath, is its partner. What we love when it's lost or damaged makes us the most mad. And that's where God's at. God is eternally love. Now that sin has entered into the world, that's brought in wrath, but it's only brought in wrath because he is loving. Again, you know, if you came into my house to harm my wife or my son or my daughters, and I said, whatever, you would say, I don't love them. You wouldn't say, oh, that's great that you don't have anger issues. You would say, you don't love your family enough. And you would be totally dead on. If I got angry and opposed whoever was coming into my house to hurt my family, you wouldn't say, oh, stop your anger issues. You would say, man, that guy loves his family. Let's root for him. If God does the same thing, though, we're like, oh, we don't like him when he's like that. I think the problem is less with God and more with us. We don't want a God and we're looking for any reason to avoid him. Now, I'm not saying it's not scary and it's not really troubling when you read about what he does. Again, he's not a tame lion, but he's always a loving lion. He's always good. And those two things go together.
I don't know if we've talked about hate on Craving Answers, Craving God or not, but maybe we should do that.
Yeah.
Maybe Larry can let us know whether we've covered that or not, and then he can chastise me for not having a better memory. But there is a difference, you know, when Jesus says something like, the person who does not hate mother or father.
Yes.
I think that's a pretty tough.
That'll wake you up.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah. Maybe we should talk about that sometime.
Let's do it.
You've been listening to Craving Answers, Craving God, and thanks for spending some time with us. If you are in some way blessed by these discussions, please tell your friends about us. We welcome your comments and criticisms. Please email any thoughts you might like to share to cacg@stjamesglencarbon.org. For Pastor Aaron Miller and Production Manager Larry O'Leary, I'm Chuck Rathert.